The Lord be with you. At first glance, that passage that Natalie just read for us, which seems like a bit of a cultural artifact, doesn't seem especially helpful or applicable or enriching for lives like ours. It seems like a weird, out-of-touch argument that maybe we didn't need to hear, using some fantastic sort of hypotheticals, either to prove a point, I guess, or maybe just to get a cheap laugh, or maybe even to embarrass somebody. And Jesus' answer at first doesn't seem like it's very much of a help for us either. One of my favorite George Carlin, Carlin records back in the day had a whole bit that he called Heavy Mysteries. Any Carlin fans in the house? No? I see that hand. Very good. He talks about the way that him and his Roman Catholic schoolmates would contrive ridiculous hypothetical situations about personal sin just to try and confound and annoy their local priest. Like, what if you missed mandatory Eucharist after Easter? Suppose that you didn't make your Easter duty and it's Pentecost Sunday, the last day, and you're on a ship at sea. And the chaplain goes into a coma. But you wanted to receive, and it's Monday, and now it's too late. But then you cross the international dateline. Would that then be a sin, Father? Today's text does seem a lot like that. But a line of questioning that starts out as a bad faith argument for a show that doesn't really take us anywhere actually takes us somewhere. Because nestled in there amidst all the weirdness and the posturing and the rhetorical weeds are words of Jesus. And these are a peek at something radiant. In the first century, the world of Judaism was complicated. I'm not saying they had as many denominations as Christians do now, but there were a lot of factions and personalities and different varieties of readings and interpretations of Scripture. Each of them were laying claim to competing theologies and authorities in the day. Among those groups is a class of religious aristocrats called Sadducees. This happens to be the only time they ever show up in Luke's gospel. Sadducees claim to trace their lineage back to Zadok, the high priest of the first temple, back from the storied days of David and Solomon. They were born into wealth and status. They kept mansions in the city and they vacationed in palatial summer homes by the sea. Sadducees got to rub shoulders with a different class of powerful, influential, cosmopolitan sorts of people. I could imagine them putting on fine parties and pulling strings and associating with the right sorts. I could see them inviting the gentry to retire to the study for cigars and brandy after supper. The devout and pious of Jerusalem no doubt called the Sadducees collaborators. Their reputations were sullied by the cozy relationship they had with the foreign Roman occupiers. Of course, people hate the rich snobs who are working for the enemy. But the Sadducees could reply to such charges by simply pointing to one magnificent building, the source of their power and their influence. And that building was Herod's second temple in Jerusalem. A famous, colossal marvel of its day, the focal point of Judaism. The Sadducees and their families managed all of the political goings-on there, the bureaucracy of the place, and as long as the temple remained the political and religious center of the life of a nation, Sadducees could hope to keep riding the gravy train. Now, if you ever do find yourself a religious figure under scrutiny for what looks like self-serving or even corrupt practices, a little bit of convenient theology is a good thing. You will need a theological line of defense, a biblical rationale even, that explains why, despite all appearances, you and your team are actually on the right side. This is a time-honored practice, and it's happening even today. The Sadducees' line of reasoning was focused heavily, if not exclusively, on Mosaic law, what we call the first five books of the Bible in our canon. As you read these passages, sometimes Mosaic law sounds a lot like it was written by George Carlin and his friends. Okay, so if all of the hair on my head falls out and I develop a massive rash, do I still have to go to church? Or suppose I'm having a fight with one of the other guys, and just when it looks like I might win, his wife sneaks up behind me and grabs me by the privates. What then? You have to imagine these hypotheticals had some sort of origin story. What sort of hypothetical then did the Sadducees have for Jesus? And today's text prompts us and the first readers of the text, who would have been Greek readers, who wouldn't have been familiar with Mosaic law. He gives them a key little detail. Sadducees didn't believe in any sort of afterlife, a resurrection or a hereafter, no final reward or punishment or life after death. There's no sign of afterlife in those five books, as far as they could tell. In their view, when a soul dies and a body dies, the end, roll the credits. Which is a pretty convenient theological stance to take for people who are playing fast and loose with ethics. It's not that deep, you guys. Make the most of it, because this is all there is. And so, here at last, we land in today's reading. The hypothetical involved something called levirate marriage, or simply put, brother-in-law marriage. Lacking any personal agency, in the event of the death of her husband, a woman's brother-in-law would, ideally, take her into his household and legally marry her, making the best of a difficult situation. In a strictly patriarchal society, this would have served multiple purposes, not the least of which was protecting her from exposure and poverty. It also helped consolidate families, carry on the family name. Probably wasn't anybody's first choice, but would have hopefully been beneficial to her situation. It was also an extremely practical financial arrangement, ensuring that her holdings, maybe even her children, whatever she owned, would stay with the family. So the Sadducees walk up to Jesus. Okay, so Jesus, there's this woman married to a guy with six brothers. There's a hint of cruelty in the Sadducees' telling of this story, as this woman is widowed and remarried and widowed over and over again. And in the end, finally, the question that is asked, whose husband is she anyways? Hilarious, am I right, fellas? They have based their whole way of life on this no afterlife theology. So naturally, they're hoping to show that resurrection and an afterlife are just doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, how would that even work? They have, however, made some miscalculations. Jesus makes short work of their argument with a clever reference to Moses' famous encounter with the burning bush, where he says, where he speaks of the Lord as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, now he is God not of the dead, but of the living, for to him all of them are alive. Check and mate, Sadducees, there right in your own first five books. I guess you fellas might need to do another read through while you're making your personal theology. Our text today ends with the scribes congratulating Jesus. You have spoken well. But that's not the part of the story that really stuck out for me. Because listen to this part. Jesus said to them, "Those who belong to this age may marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry or are given in marriage. This one line gives all of us a little glimpse of what into the world that Jesus calls the next age. And in that age, people won't marry, and they won't be given in marriage. More to the point, women will no longer be married off or given in marriage. In the next age, none of these complications or compromises or hypotheticals will apply at all. And neither will there be a system which requires a woman to give all of her agency to the mercy of the men in her life. Did Jesus just smash the patriarchy, ladies? For that matter, what other systems of hierarchy or oppression will be done away with? All of the messy hypotheticals and compromises and arrangements which we take for granted as a part of our everyday life in this world, they won't apply in the next age. In the reconciliation of all things, heaven only knows what sort of connections we might be capable of, how deep and how wide that embrace. The bosom of creation made fresh and new and alive in ways that we could never imagine. We lack the capacity for it. I mean, sure, when it works out, marriage can and has often been a fine thing for a world like ours. It can be practical, it can be useful even. As we earthlings walk this hard land and we make our way among so many troubled souls, we need comfort. We need companionship. As we face humanity with all of its meanness and stupidity, a companion like this can be a gift. On a planet with so much beauty and danger and unfairness, a life with so much uncertainty and weariness calls for tenderness and care. And I speak from experience. Marriage is okay for those who choose it. Marriage can make, for many of us, companions, lovers, partners, family, tenderness, home. Marriage can be a fine venue for a life shared. But despite what people often write in their wedding vows, though, the convention of marriage is not the ultimate relationship. As a church, we rightly honor and celebrate marriage. But as a church, in a culture like ours, and a society broadly speaking, we typically take this to ridiculous extremes. Wildly overselling marriage as the high point of existence, the ultimate relationship. And if you doubt what I'm saying about any of this, just ask one of your single friends. According to Jesus, marriage doesn't even make the cut. In the end, when all things are brought near and made new again, what else could the Creator have in mind? Doesn't include marriage. Heaven only knows what sort of understanding and nearness and connection the next age holds for us. There are yet unknown sorts of friendship and companionship that are holy and dear and still unknown to us. They're beyond usefulness or benefit. They're certainly not transactional. They're definitely not an arrangement where one is taken or given. Friends, the hypothetical started this way. This isn't even really a story about marriage. This is Jesus hinting at the dream of God for the next age when all things are made new. In the meantime, we currently live in this age. It's a place of hard choices, compromises, less than ideal situations. We live in a damaged and lopsided here and now. A world where we do our best with what we're given. We hold dear to people and places, and we let go Sometimes we have the illusion of agency. Quite often we do not. We take each step sometimes with our very best wisdom and sometimes when we don't even have a clue. For now, we are making the best of it. Friends, the Spirit of Christ is at work in the world, giving shape to a new people, celebrating life together in companionship and deep friendship. At their best, the disciples of Christ in history have embodied mercy, freedom, kinship, connection, and generosity. Real and dear connection at its peak in the next age, yes, but now a sign of the kinship that we were made for. Friends, none of us are living a hypothetical. Even if sometimes it feels like life can be a series of cruel jokes. And I don't know if I've ever seen someone help the world with cynical detachment or disregard. But I know for this time that we are given in this age, we have opportunities to reflect, to give shape, maybe even to a sliver of God's vision for this world, to form our lives and our life together around this vision, to bless and embrace, to share our hearts and our lives, to care for people and places as we live out our days. But, okay, hear me out. So, hypothetically speaking, what would it look like for a people to take even a sliver of such a vision of creation to heart and make a whole way of life out of it? Hypothetically, of course. Amen. Thanks be to God.